Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Ken Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So in today's episode, I'm going to be airing the opening keynote that he gave at the Meaningful XR conference that happened this past weekend at the Oregon Reality Lab and University of Oregon here in Portland, Oregon. The title of the talk is called Patterns of Meaning, Transformation, and Impact in XR. And so Meaningful XR is coming from more of an academic perspective, looking at how you start to quantify different aspects of impact when it comes to XR experiences. And so I wanted to give a bit of an overview of some of the phenomenological framework that I use from experiential design and immersive storytelling, but also to look at the brand new study that just came out from Impulse, looking at the different behavioral changes and also trying to categorize different aspects of their results into this phenomenological framework of the different aspects of the behavior change, the feelings, the thoughts and relationships, and also the embodiment aspect of it. And so this is kind of like my take. And in the end of it, I wanted to start to get into some of these broader theories of change from the transformation economy, Mariana Mazzucato, Kat Cizek, and William Mercurio, but also Thomas Kuhn, paradigm shifts, and this Hegelian dialectic and other process philosophy perspectives on the process of change. Oh, one other note is that this was a talk that I gave that has a lot of slides that I think you can listen to it and you'll get the gist of what I'm talking about. But I think watching the video will be a little bit more of a full, rich experience because I'm speaking to the slides and not always saying everything that's written down. So highly recommend checking out the video, which will be posted within the show notes. So covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this opening keynote talk that I gave happened on May 30th, 2026 at the Meaningful XR conference at the Oregon Reality Lab at the University of Oregon in Portland, Oregon. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in. My name is Kent Bai, and today I'm going to be talking to you about the patterns of meaning, transformation, and impact in XR. So since May of 2014, I've been doing the Voices of VR podcast, and about one third of my coverage has been around immersive storytelling. And so today I'm going to be talking about a number of different things, including experiential and phenomenological framework that I use to understand XR, the Impulse Impact Study that just came out yesterday, the Transformation Economy, Mission-Oriented Change, and Co-Creation. And then I'll be digging into some other models for paradigm shifts, and then end with some closing thoughts on AI and friction. So a lot of my work has been going to festivals like Sundance New Frontier, South by Southwest Immersive, Tribeca Immersive, Venice Immersive, and IFA DocLab, where I see a lot of these artists and storytellers who are using XR to tell stories in new ways. And a lot of those haven't necessarily made it out into the wide world in terms of wide distribution, but there is this kind of whole movement of location-based entertainment where a lot of those immersive storytelling experiences are starting to be shown. And so I just got done writing a report that came out in April. It's called IFA DocLab Immersive Think Tank Report. It's a 121-page report where I'm sort of documenting both like this emerging indie XR revolution that's happening with location-based entertainment, but also just some reflections on some of the challenges for getting the work out there. And in that, there was a moment where someone was asking, are we changing things with these pieces? And so, you know, for artists and creators, you're making these experiences and trying to create the most intense emotional experience that you can, but there's going to be potentially like a whole other impact campaign or other activists or other folks are using your piece of media that you're creating as a part of catalyzing more change. And so there's artists that are making stuff, and then maybe what's this thing that happens after you make it that gets it out into the wide world and people engaging with it to actually catalyze that change. And so there's a number of different studies that have come out. There was one, Deepening Engagement and Learning and Impact of Virtual Reality, that was through On the Morning You Wake to the End of the World. There's also a study that just came out yesterday from Anagram and sponsored by Agog called The Results of Impact Carried Out by a Mixed Reality Experience of Impulse. And then there's kind of more of the behind the scenes that happened with that that I got a hold of. I'm not sure if they're going to release that publicly, but I had a chance to look at it. It gives a little bit more context for how they actually did the study and everything. For anybody that's in this room would be likely to want to see the details of what were the questions they asked and sort of the nuances of that study. But the high level results of that study just came out, and I'm going to be digging into that a little bit more. But before I do that, one of the things that I've noticed in like a report like that is that there's a lot of numbers, and it's like, okay, what does this mean? So sometimes you can look at that and be like, what is this really happening? So for me, I take a phenomenological and experiential approach of what is my own experience. And that's sort of coming from a process philosophy perspective where, you know, for Alfred North Whitehead,
he sees your direct experience as an exemplification of the nature of reality rather than an exception. A lot of times with reductive materialism, they'll say your consciousness is an illusion. Well, that's actually the only thing that I know is real, is my own direct experience. And so there's a bit of reductive materialism that is sort of denying my own experience. So I'm going to be starting with how I start to break down experience through quality, context, character, and story. And then we'll start to dive into some of the other studies through that lens of phenomenology and then digging into some other models for change and transformation. Okay, so I'm going to share a few anecdotal experiences I've had on the festival circuit that really changed me. This first piece is called Collider by Anagram. And in it, you are going into an experience. They ask you to think of a memory where either someone has power over you or you have power over someone else. And that depended on this asymmetrical experience where one person's in VR and the other person's not in VR. And the other person's kind of puppeteering you and controlling you. So it's really exploring these dynamics of power and control. And by asking you to think of a memory of that, it sort of contextualized it by my own memory that I'm projecting onto the experience as I'm going through it. And it was super powerful, especially having gone through it two times to see the kind of relationship that I have on both sides of that equation. Then there was a piece that was called Operation Aspen that was from Condition One, and it was a 360-degree video where they were basically these direct activists who were infiltrating a farm and showing the conditions of chickens. And it's a 360 video, so you get to visually see the conditions of these chickens. And so after I watched that, I was like, wow, there's like, when I'm making a choice in the grocery store, I'm not going to buy anything other than cage-free eggs now after I've watched this experience. It's one example that I saw an experience where the kind of out of sight, out of mind type of relational dynamics of my consumer choices, it was made clear to me the impact of that by watching this piece and having empathy for those chickens. There's a piece called Lesbian Similar that was at IFA Doc Lab, and that it's an interactive game that goes through different aspects of the coming out experience. You have to say, I am gay, while you're wearing your VR headset in public. And so just to feel that sort of tension of saying that while other people are around, it sort of starts to give you a little bit of a flavor of that. But there's also parts in the experience where you're holding hands with your same-sex partner, and you start to get grief from the outside. And if you don't hold your hand of your partner, they start to get mad at you. So there's this experience of like those different dynamics that after I saw this, I was walking around Amsterdam and seeing same-sex couples holding their hands. And I was like, wow, that's actually an act of rebellion that I didn't fully appreciate before I saw that experience. And then there's this piece called Horizon, where this was just an experience at IFA Doc Lab where I had a conversation with a 15-year-old who was an actor who was asking me to tell them about the future that they were going to live in 30 years later. And I was 45 at the time, so I was the age at which they were going to be in 30 years. And I had to describe to them what their future looked like. It was a speculative imagination experience, but it forced me to, they're asking, like, they live in Amsterdam, are they going to be able to live there? Because if the sea levels are rising, what's their life going to look like? And I had to be confronted with that and be like, wow, do I say the truth as to what I think their future is going to be? Or do I say, oh, well, it's going to be a fine, you know, it'll work out for you, but everyone else will be screwed. So it's sort of like this kind of experience where you're confronted by what does the future look like? And I'm actually, you know, an elder in that sense, and I have more power politically. And so there's like a metaphoric reflection of like, here's the youth of the future, the next generation, and I'm being asked to tell them what their future is. So there's no technology in this experience. It's just me having a conversation. But in that context of immersive theater, it's starting to give this kind of like speculative design. And so each of these have like a center of gravity of a different elemental flavor. So you have the agency of the game, you have the speaking and the interaction of the horizon, you have the cinematic tradition of the Operation Aspen, and then the Collider is much more of an embodied experience that is kind of like this ritual I'm going through. So I look at it through active presence, mental, social presence, emotional presence, and embodied and environmental presence. And each of these qualities of presence are happening all at once, all at the same time, but there's going to be ways that gaming is going to be focused more on the active presence. And so we can actually look at the different communication media and see like video games are going to be much more about agency. And so the game design is coming about how are you expressing your will into the experience. And then you have mental and social presence are all the ways that you use language as abstractions to communicate, but also to connect to other people. And so you have literature, you have what's the speaking, how are you getting knowledge, the semiotic transmission of meaning. So maybe you're creating symbolic representations of things that you have to decode it and encode it like a dream logic. And but that's also like the internet and the World Wide Web. And then you have the emotional presence, which is a lot of the consonants and dissonance cycles that come from the editing and kind of the building and releasing of tension, but also in music and lighting as you watch a film, it's all about like the way that it modulates and impacts your emotions. And so there's a whole cinematic tradition that's coming in through pulling in different aspects into experiential design. And then finally, we're starting to bring in our body into the experience. So you're pulling in like architecture, theater, and dance, but also your sensory experience. And so this is where XR is kind of bringing all these things together. So all these different design disciplines are all going to be fused together in this kind of interdisciplinary fusion within XR. But you can start to look at it through the lens of presence in order to kind of understand how you're starting to combine all these different things. So essentially, it's taking action, making choices, emotional immersion, and sensory experience. And I'll sort of take a step back into the broader experiential design framework that I use. So there's this quote from Margaret McKee, who is a screenwriter, and he says, "True character is revealed in the choices a human being makes under pressure. The greater the pressure, the deeper the revelation, the truer the choice to the character's essential nature." So in essence, when you're watching a story, you're watching somebody else make choices and take action. But when you're put into an immersive experience, you are the one who's making choices and taking action. And so you're placed within a context. You're making choices and you're taking actions within that context. And then in some ways, some part of your essential character is being revealed in that. And there's a story that's unfolding over time. So I sort of boil it down into context, quality, character, and story. So quality, we've already talked about a little bit, but it's worth digging in a little bit more just in terms of this crowd may be familiar with different theories of presence from like Mel Slater. So we'll dig into the presence theories. And so Slater has the place illusion, plausibility illusion, which he first started to define back in 2009. And so the place illusion is a strong illusion of being in a place in spite of sure knowledge that you are actually not there. And the plausibility illusion is the illusion that what is apparently happening is not really happening, even though you know for sure that is not. So you can think about the plausibility illusion as all the different ways that your kind of mental constructs of you being fooled, of your expectations that you are actually there when you're not. And the place illusion is the fuel that you're being transported into another place. And then Slater in 2022 started to add other dimensions of illusions. And so he added the co-presence illusion as well as the body ownership illusion. But you can see that there's not anything within the fire or water element. That's because for Slater, he's only looking at the things that are very unique to VR. You can have emotions and agency and other things, but he's looking at very unique illusionary kind of framing. But I think that when you look at experiential design, I don't think we should be bounded by just this kind of VR technology, but looking at more broadly of all these different equivalence classes of presence. And so you can think about it as behaviors, thoughts and relations, feelings and sensations. And so Dustin Chertoff was actually somebody who saw the same thing I saw, but was like predated me back in 2008, 2010. He was doing his master's work and he saw that there's this whole branch of experiential advertising that actually had a much more robust models of presence. And so he took his vibe as being active, cognitive, relational, sensory, and affective, which functionally is equivalent to what I kind of independently came up from the elements later. There's also experiential and marketing and strategic experiential modules, which is act, think and relate, sense and feel. And then there's measuring brand experiences, which you think about as behavioral, intellectual, sensory and affective. And then you have the OODA loop from Boyd, which is observe, orient, decide and act. You think about it as this process that's unfolding where you're taking the sensory input, you're synthesizing everything through your emotions and making a decision and then acting. And then you can think about it as behaviors and agency, thoughts and relations, feelings and experiential elements, and then the sensations and the immersion. So as I look at these different studies, when I think about change, they're often addressing one of these things. You're going to change your thoughts, change your behaviors, give you some sort of immersive experiences. But ultimately, it's like the degree to which that it's able to move your emotions. If it has a really powerful emotional impact, then these other things will follow. So in some sense, the feelings and emotions are the most base thing that as people who are creating experiences want to make sure that they tell the best story or to engage people's emotions in every way that they can. So again, active presence, mental and social presence, embodied environmental presence, and emotional presence. Okay, let's move on to context. So context are all the different domains of human experience that we have in our life. And so this is sort of like archetypal representation of self and other, your career. And so when I ask people, what is the ultimate potential of VR? They'll answer like, well, it's going to change the way that we learn or change medicine or change the way that we work or the way that we express ourselves through virtual representations or change our relationships or change the way that we connect to friends and family. So there's all these different contextual domains. And you can also think about these contextual domains as domains of identity. Who you are at work is different than who you are with your friends, is different than who you are with your family. And so for each of these contextual domains is an expression of your identity. And so this is something that Helen Nissenbaum, with the contextual theory of privacy, says that for each of these contextual domains, there's appropriate flows of information that are appropriate to that context. If you're at your bank, you give bank information, but when you're at your doctors, you don't necessarily tell them how much money you have in your bank, aside from, you know, needing to have health insurance and to know that you can actually pay for it. But you're also not telling your banker your health information. So there's different information that, depending on the context, there's an appropriate flow of that information. But context is really important, both in XR, because you're being transported into a context, but more and more increasingly with AI is seeing, like, what's the context window, is explicitly priming the large language models with what they call in linguistics pragmatics, which is that different words have different meanings based upon the context. So context ends up being a really important thing, but in XR, you're actually being put into that physical context. And when you're in that physical context virtually, then it starts to evoke different aspects of your consciousness. So there's a relationship between context, privacy, and identity. This is actually from a paper that I did called Privacy Pitfalls of Contextually Aware AI, Since Making Frameworks for Context. And so if there's contextually aware AI that's always listening to our context, it violates principles of contextual integrity. So I was trying to make this argument that, okay, here's all the personally identifiable information that's available across all these different contexts where you can start to see a model for context. But understanding context is going to be increasingly important for people in XR as also as you move forward with AI. There's also Alex Mandalas did a whole world-building mandala where he's starting to look at different scales of the individual, family, community, and world. As you go outward, it's increasing those scales, but also you can start to see these different contextual domains that he has in there in terms of government and culture and self and body. Okay, so that's the context. The character is, there's a connection between value theory and the archetypal character. So from Whitehead's perspective, then every single moment is not neutral or valueless, but it's every single possibility of the moment is filled with value. And so that's kind of a piece from process philosophy. What that means is that there's kind of archetypal character to every single moment, but also within yourself, you have your own sense of your character that you're expressing. And so this is something from storytelling, you think about, you know, plot and character, but you can start to think about it in terms of like virtue ethics of like truth, beauty, and goodness, but also like dimensions of integrity, discernment, love, respect, humility, diligence. Some of these experiences, you may be focusing on one of these different dimensions. And so virtue ethics has this continuum of from one polarity of the malefic and more of the sort of benefic aspect. And so starting to think about these character dimensions can be thought about when I think about meaningful XR and trying to really address these, then you may be focusing on one character trait, like Collider was thinking about the difference between power and control and your autonomy over that power, who has power over you. And there's also needs and feelings, which I think is like a core motivation as we start to think about character plot and what are the feelings and needs that they need. And you can also think about this in terms of like when you make these XR experiences, are you addressing some core need or addressing some core feeling? Okay, so that's the character. And finally, the story. There's a spectrum of story authorship, and so there's going to be, on the one end, authored narratives that are going to have no agency or impact on the story. That's essentially like watching a film, where you watch it. So there's nothing that you do when you watch a film. It's going to be the same film every time you watch it. And then you go to the generative narrative, where your agency is actually changing how that story unfolds. And so you have the spectrum of authorship, where Vilbertz and Klug had this whole storytelling spectrum of different types of stories. And so as I go through, there's the three-act structure, which is basically like Aristotelian, you're just watching the kind of normal building and releasing of that tension of the narrative over time. Then you have interactive traditional stories where you start to have a little bit of agency, but that doesn't necessarily change anything significantly. It's kind of flavoring your experience, but you're not necessarily changing the plot or the story. But everyone sort of gets the same story beats, but you may have a specific flavor that's unique to you. So you kind of have these light branching that still converges at the end. And then you have the branching path stories where basically this is where you have to spell out every sort of narrative path that's possible. It takes a lot of work to do that. And sometimes when people go through it, they didn't even know that they made any choices at all. And it's sort of like, it doesn't always necessarily mean it has a good narrative experience, but you could also have the potential where you're able to really finely tune and give people the experience exactly what they need, given this type of structure. And there's more open-ended stories where it's more of like a possibility space and open world that you're interacting with. And then to add a little bit more of that narrative, you have Facade where they have a drama manager. So based upon the actions that you've taken, they look at all the possible story beats that they could give you to give you the best story based upon the decisions that you made up to that point. So it's kind of trying to blend giving you agency, but also trying to dynamically give you the best story. And then finally, you have these kind of fully player-driven stories that as you are interacting with a possibility space, it's more of an open world at that point. And it's more of a sandbox that the narrative tension becomes a little bit more difficult, because at that point, it's more about your agency as you're exploring the world, and it's more about how are you able to express your actions and your will the most rather than telling a compelling story. So at this point, at the other end of the spectrum, it becomes difficult to really shape a story that's as compelling. Okay, so that's the context, quality, character, and story. So these are the kind of equivalence classes that I look at and start to think about when I look at meaningful XR. What's it mean to have change or transformation? It's addressing each of these different things, each of these different dimensions. So let's look at the impulse impact study briefly to kind of unpack a little bit of how I start to look at what they did and start to see it through this experiential design lens. So impulse, it's a piece about ADHD. It's available. You should definitely check it out if you haven't seen it. And they use a lot of mixed reality. And it's basically an oral history storytelling, because ADHD's got so many different expressions. And so they give you a little bit of a flavor of different people who have that, but they are putting you into these spatial contexts and also trying to recreate different aspects of overwhelm and trying to give you experientially an experience of ADHD through this experience. And so it's a really powerful piece. I have an unpublished interview with Amy Abdallah, and she told me that she wanted to be hands-off and let them do the study, but they were asking her, well, what was your intention? And so you start to see some of the different intentions that she had with creating this. And, you know, it's sort of an undifferentiated list. And so I'm going to show this list again with, there's going to be a societal impact on outcomes, a proactive adaptations, empowerment and support. So how are they taking action after they see this piece? So then there's all the different dimensions of their learning and the knowledge that come from it, the importance of diagnosis, the appreciation of condition, the condition severity, the societal and economic awareness. And also there's a relational component that pulls in here as well in the next section. And there's an experiential understanding of ADHD. You're having over time, you have a direct embodied experience of that, and also hopefully cultivating different aspects of compassion and self-compassion. And then there's the embodied experience of overwhelm and reflective space. So you can start to see, okay, this was their intention. And now when they actually did this study, one data point is that a month after doing impulse, over half the people who suspected they had ADHD symptoms had either seen a doctor or spoken to a counselor. So one thing I want to point out here is that this was a part of the study. So they were doing it before, right after, and they were asked, okay, we're going to follow up with you in a month, right? So they know they're on the hook to do something. So there's a bit of an accountability, even by the act of doing the study, that observation may have also impacted that. So I just want to point that out, because people just do the experience, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to follow up with it. And so here are some of the different things that they found in terms of how can you start to support people who have ADHD. So encourage healthy habits and alternatives, respect boundaries and advice, create accountability systems and support systems, promote understanding at work, learn about ADHD, share helpful resources, talk openly about ADHD, avoid assuming or labeling, but also support through awareness and empathy, and provide a safe space to talk. So just for context, these are things that were open-ended for ways that they were supporting their friends. And so these are things that they were just qualitative reporting. And so I'm just also putting it into this framework. Okay, and then finally, these were just some of the actual conclusions that they had from the study. You can basically start to break down the different ways of, like, did they have habit changes, behavior changes? And you can see there's so much about this piece. It was about learning and acquiring information and relating to other people, but also, you know, cultivating a sense of empathy was a catalyst they saw. And then also trying to create a safe space for people. Okay, so I'm going to go through some models of transformation economy, mission-oriented change, and co-creation, as also some other models. Okay, so Pine and Gilmore have this experience economy where they have commodities, goods, services, and experiences and transformations. And so as you go up, it gets more customized. And as you go down, it gets more commodification. But we all are familiar with goods and services, but they defined the experience economy in 1999 and said, we're moving into the transformation economy, which people want to have meaningful, life-changing experiences that allow them to achieve their aspirations, which I think is a lot of what meaningful XR is. So this lens of transformation economy. So we think about onboarding, offboarding. So for Pine, he says you prepare, you have the experience, and then you reflect. And then there's a follow-up, because transformation happens over time. It's changes that happen that are lasting. So you have to kind of follow up. So it's that follow-up part that is the part that doesn't necessarily already exist within the context of experience economy. So what Pine says is that all transformation is identity change, that aspirants desire to go from one thing to the next. So I aspire to be whatever it is, healthy. And then Susie Ross says that identity is all the ways that you complete the statement, I am. So I am an aspiring philosopher, and I just recently gave my first professional philosophy talk. So that's sort of an example of like having an aspiration, but then kind of living into that. Now I can say, well, am I a professional philosopher yet? Well, I'm not. Well, maybe I am, because I'm getting paid for doing this kind of philosophical work. But it's this kind of idea of, you can think about transformation in terms of what are the statements that you say I am and what do you aspire to? And so can these immersive experiences help you live into your aspirations? Marianne Mazzucato also has a mission-oriented framework, which is basically like these moonshots where they want to like have climate change. And so governments are starting to fund these different types of grand challenges, like the CCCC, which I'll talk about here at the end, is trying to do these big things and breaking up into that. And so you can say, you want to have clean oceans? Well, here's all the different things you need to do that follow from that. And then finally, there's this media fragments that just the idea that you have complete media objects, but you have fragments that are facilitating community development processes. So it could be that the whole purpose of your piece is to just facilitate a community development process. Okay, some other models for paradigm shifts. So there's Lessig's pathetic dot theory, which I think is really helpful to think about. Is this project trying to aim to change the culture? Are you trying to change a law, which is more of a policy thing? So at that level, you're trying to give politicians to try to change something. And then there's the economic market dynamics, which is more of like, are you trying to create something that's going to change the market? And then there's technological architecture and code. For Lessig, there's a way in which that even the systems of technology that we have are shaping culture in a way that is very distinct. And so you can start to think about if you're creating some sort of aspect of the stack that is trying to change people's experiences. The Hegelian dialectic, which is essentially thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. So you can think about there's some proposition, someone has an opposite. And so there's this tension of how do you transcend the limitations of one perspective and include the perspectives of the other perspective in order to synthesize those two. And so you can think about polarization that we have a lot of in our society and this kind of Hegelian dialectic, which is you're in one spot, here's an opposition. So can you start to catalyze that type of friction and paradigm shifts within the context of a piece that's really kind of introducing that antithesis for people to try to change someone's paradigm? Then there's Kuhn's paradigm shift, where there's the normal science, then you have the anomalies that are ignored, then you have the anomalies that are accepted, and then in order to have a paradigm shift, you have to have a theory that is both describing the new anomalies and existing data. So until you have that, then you have a paradigm shift. But you can be at different phases where you can have information like, oh, are there aliens and UFOs? If yes, then what's the new paradigm of the nature of reality? We don't know that because we don't actually have the clear evidence. So we're kind of in this spot where we don't know whether or not to accept that or not until we've got clear evidence. And then even if we had clear evidence, it would be like, okay, what's the new paradigm to make sense of this data? We're not at the end of the paradigm shift because we're not at that point yet. Crossing the chasm in the mainstream, you can see the technological diffusion of how information as it gets out there is going through these different phases. You can start to map that out on an S-curve and seeing how it sort of gets to different levels of market penetration. And then going through and mapping that out to the early adopters, late majority laggards. And then there's Simon Wardley who takes some of those concepts, but then props up to how there's an innovation from new ideas, custom bespoke enterprise models. It goes into cross the chasm in the mainstream, you have a product, and then it sort of is mass ubiquitous. You can sort of see smartphones is going through this diffusion, and XR is still kind of in that custom-built enterprise phase. And he's got value mapping, so he basically maps the most valuable to the least valuable, and then starts to map out across those different phases, like here's a tech stack, so you can start to understand the transformative nature of technology as it's moving. You have your different, like electricity is at the bottom, and the top is the thing that's the unique thing that you're providing to people. But this is another way of looking at value chains across those different phases of evolution. And then process philosophy is just another paradigm shift that I'm really into, and you can start to see that you're going from nouns to verbs, things to happenings, discrete individuality to active relations. So basically from the substance metaphysics into process relational philosophy is a big thing that this is another aspect that I'm really advocating for in terms of a deep underlying paradigm shift. Grant Maxwell has a book called The Dynamics of Transformation that he's basically identifying each of these different philosophical principles into this new paradigm. And then he's also did a whole book on integration and difference that is looking at this kind of Hegelian dialectic across 13 different philosophers. And that's in a book called Integration and Difference. And then finally, AI and friction, just some final thoughts. In my report for IFA Doc Lab, I decided that I couldn't talk about AI objectively. I had so much situated knowledge and perspective that I couldn't talk about AI from a view from nowhere. I have a lot of strong opinions about it that you can dig into the report. But essentially, like AICon is a really great, Emily Embender and Alex Hanna, where they're starting to flesh out all the different ways in which that they are kind of deconstructing different aspects of AI hype. And then there's also just this idea of friction, of how technology is trying to reduce all the friction in our lives. And actually, it's human beings that we start to introduce that friction and that we need to kind of embrace that friction. And also think about how the reduction of all that friction is actually destroying democracy. We have this democratic backsliding into fascism. So we have these tech billionaires that are kind of removing the friction, towards this kind of like authoritarian state. So we need to reintroduce friction. So how can friction revitalize civic society is a question that the CCCC, which is the Creative Industries Immersive Impact Coalition in Netherlands, $250 million, they're giving to artists to collaborate with researchers to figure out how can you start to revitalize civic society by having these type of immersive experiences with groups of people to kind of have these magic circle where you start to play with ways that you're engaging friction and revitalizing democracy. So that's some like exciting things that I see on the frontier. So yeah, that's what I talked about today, experiential and phenomenological framework, impact info study, transformation economy, mission-oriented change, co-creation, other models for paradigm shifts, and AI and friction. And yeah, that's all that I have, so thank you.
So that was the opening keynote talk at the Meaningful XR conference called Patterns of Meaning, Transformation, and Impact in XR that I gave this past weekend at the Oregon Reality Lab at the University of Oregon in Portland, Oregon. So I have a number of different takeaways about this talk is that, first of all, well, there's these larger questions around how do you start to quantify change and transformation. There does seem to be this moving beyond just the kind of the abstractions of the mind and the language, and that there doesn't seem to be enough that's coming from that pure information perspective, that people want to be moved and feel something and experience something in their body in a visceral, immersive way, but also to have a connection between other ways that you can restore your agency within the context of this experience, but also express that agency within the wide world to bring about deeper change, either at the collective scale or in a personal scale. And so there's this open call that's happening from AGOG that is looking at using immersive media to have change when it comes to climate futures and this larger issue of climate change. And so the deadline is coming up here on June 12th, 2026. And so I'll have a conversation in the next episode with Chip Giller and Amy Seidenmoor where we're talking about some of these things. But there is this open question as to what is the theory of change that you have and how are you going to actually bring about change in the wider world once you create immersive media. And so that's kind of like an open question that each person as they are in this industry is going to answer, because they're going to have that theory, but also have some way of quantifying it or measuring it and showing it to folks like AGOG to show that they're actually bringing about change in the world. And I think even themselves, they see that when it comes to different aspects of climate change, that climate communication that only relies upon technical, abstract, or overwhelming details that are catastrophizing, are there ways that you can use the kind of speculative imagination of immersive experiences, but also kind of restore agency and participation and civic engagement, creating more emotional valence, emotional proximity, and more embodiment and connection with other people. And so there's ways in which that the immersive media is trying to embody these different aspects of the paradigm shift. One of the things that I'd like to think about it is that we need to kind of return to different aspects of that perspective that is preferencing our direct phenomenological experiences, our emotions, our feelings, our bodies, our agency, our relationships, our mind, all synthesized together is what XR is doing. And so for me, I'm trying to like use these phenomenological frameworks to kind of return back to that phenomenological perspective so that we can move people to take action to bring about change in the wider world. So that's all that I have for today, and I just wanted to thank you for listening to the Voices of VR podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, then please do spread the word, tell your friends, and consider becoming a member of the Patreon. This is a listener-supported podcast, and so I do rely upon donations from people like yourself in order to continue to bring in this coverage. So you can become a member and donate today at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.